From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Both sides in the Derek Chauvin trial have now rested. Closing arguments will begin on Monday. This morning, Chauvin decided not to take the stand in defense of charges he faces in the killing of George Floyd. The former Minneapolis police officer invoked the Fifth Amendment and spoke in the courtroom for the first time when Judge Peter Cahill asked him the following questions.
Is this your decision not to testify?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. Do you have any questions about your right to remain silent or to testify on your own behalf?
Not at this time, I don't.
For more on arguments in this trial, we're joined by Georgetown law professor and former federal prosecutor Paul Butler. Paul, welcome to Here and Now.
It's great to be here.
Yes. So what do you make of Chauvin's decision not to testify?
This was the most important decision of his life. Legally, his side does not even have to put on a defense. The government has the heavy burden of proof, and Chauvin has a constitutional right not to testify. Still, jurors like to hear from the accused person. The concern for the defense was that Chauvin would be destroyed by the prosecutors on cross-examination, or that his testimony could have opened the door to evidence of the many complaints that citizens have made against him in the past in other cases.
To your point that the burden is on the prosecution to really build this case, the goal of the defense is really to sow reasonable doubt in the mind of at least one juror. In your opinion, have they done that during these 2 days of presenting their witnesses?
So the prosecution was very effective at presenting strong witnesses who suggested that Chauvin's use of force violated his training and police regulations. The prosecution's medical experts were united in saying that Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck was a substantial factor in Floyd's death. And that's the legal requirement to convict Chauvin of murder and manslaughter. So I think the defense was not great on use of force, but better on causation. The problem for the defense is how this case is different from most other prosecutions of police officers. Because in those cases, the cops have shot somebody, and that's a split-second decision. Here, Chauvin had more than 9 minutes, and he didn't adapt his use of force, even during the more than 2 minutes that he knew Mr. Floyd didn't have a pulse. On causation of death, in the course of the trial, defense lawyers have suggested that Mr. Floyd died of a drug overdose or heart disease or lung disease or COVID-19. Or carbon monoxide poisoning.
Right.
And they don't have to prove any of these theories. They just have to create reasonable doubt about whether Chauvin is responsible for Mr. Floyd's death.
Well, on that argument of carbon monoxide, this morning prosecutors asked to bring back their expert pulmonologist, Dr. Martin Tobin, to rebut defense medical expert Dr. David Fowler's testimony yesterday about carbon monoxide from the police car and how that might have contributed to Floyd's death. The judge warned that there could actually be a mistrial over this. Why is the prosecution doing this? Is this a risky strategy?
Well, that testimony concluded with no mistrial. The judge said that he would not allow evidence about test results regarding carbon monoxide found in Mr. Floyd's system, but he allowed the expert to talk generally about carbon monoxide poisoning. And Tanya, I think strategically, this was a huge win for the prosecution because the expert witness who testified, Dr. Tobin, might have been the government's best witness. He's an excellent communicator to judges. He's very knowledgeable, and he puts things in a way that you don't have to be a doctor to understand. And so the prosecution got to have the last word with a very effective witness.
Can we talk about something else? Excited delirium. Earlier this week, a Minneapolis police officer testified that police in the city are trained to recognize signs of this, of excited delirium, to bolster the defense's claim that an agitated George Floyd put up unusual resistance in his arrest. This is a disputed concept. Can you explain a little bit about why, and why did Chauvin's lawyers actually bring this up?
Excited delirium is a theory that when people are in very stressful situations, they have physical and mental reactions that can include acting aggressively, and having superhuman strength. But it's a term that defense attorneys use more than doctors because it's not actually recognized by most medical associations. And defense attorneys often use it to justify violence against Black bodies, like when defense attorney Eric Nelson, in this case, told the jurors that they would see that three police officers could not control George Floyd. And studies show that police are much more likely to say that Black suspects had excited delirium than white suspects. It plays on stereotypes of Black thugs with brute strength, high on drugs. The problem for the defense is that the jurors have gotten to know Mr. Floyd, and that's probably not the picture that they have of him.
Paul Butler, thank you so much for your time and expertise. Paul Butler is a professor at the George Washington University Law Center.
Always a pleasure.
Well, to a place now where COVID-19 numbers are staggering, India has for the first time registered more than 200,000 new cases in just a single day. More than 14 million infections in all. That's second only to the U.S. Let's bring in the BBC's Yogita LeMay in Mumbai. And Yogita, we need context here. Your country is huge, 1.3 billion people. So some people might say, well, 200,000 cases a day, that's terrible, but maybe that's relative to the population. The U.S. had about 48,000 on a recent day. What are people there saying?
Well, yes. I mean, if you look at it, you know, compared to the size of India's population, the number of cases are still quite low. If you also look at the deaths that are taking place, not just every day, but overall deaths, as a, you know, compared to the size of the population, those are lower than badly hit countries like the US or the UK or Brazil, for example. I think the issue is more central to, you know, what people are afraid of is that medical infrastructure is already falling short. I'm in the city of Mumbai, which is one of the worst affected areas. It's in the state of Maharashtra, which accounts for the largest chunk of new cases and new deaths. I've been speaking to doctors here over the past 10 days. All of them telling me every day they get dozens of phone calls from families who are asking for an ICU bed, a critical care bed, a ventilator bed for their loved ones, and they're having to turn them away because there simply aren't enough. I've spoken to families who've lost loved ones. I spoke to a man who took his 73-year-old mother to six hospitals. There was no critical care bed available for her. She died on her way to the seventh. I've spoken to the owner of a hospital who says that he will run out of oxygen supplies in 3 days. And therefore, yes, you know, headline numbers matter, but it's really these stories on the ground. Medical facilities are falling short, not just here, but in many parts of India. And the surge as well, although it's worst in this region, we are seeing it in many parts of India. The capital, Delhi, recorded a staggering 17,000 new cases yesterday, just that one city alone, and more than 100 deaths.
Yeah, well, and why is this happening? Is the thinking that it's variants that are spreading it more quickly? Is it that people are not, you know, taking precautions? We know that the country has administered more than 100 million doses of vaccines, but again, it's a country of 1.3 billion people. So what's the sense of why there is a spread?
So the epidemiologists that I've been speaking to, the experts on this matter, all of them believe that this new rapid fierce surge that we are seeing is down to new variants. They're also saying that there are new mutant variants that have formed here in India, and they believe that there needs to be more genomic sequencing, there needs to be more investigation to find out about those and how those behave so that a proper strategy can be planned to combat the second wave.
Yeah. Well, so you have now 200,000 new cases a day. That's a number that's doubled in 10 days. And you have events like Wednesday's very auspicious day for Hindu pilgrims, in which something like a million people might have bathed in the Ganges River in a religious festival. So who knows what the spread might be there? There are weekend lockdowns. Is that expected to expand?
Well, you know, it does feel like different parts of India are living in sort of, a parallel universe. For example, I'm in Mumbai, where we've had strict restrictions come in from yesterday, where we've been told that people should not be going outdoors unless it's for essential things like buying food or buying medicines. Only essential services have been allowed to remain open. In the city of Delhi as well, new restrictions were announced today, a curfew over weekends. And then you see in a part of India, hundreds of thousands gathering together in the northern town of Haridwar. And, we've not just seen mass gathering for, that festival. We've seen mass gatherings for political rallies. There are elections due to take place in four states in India, so there's been a lot of campaigning going on. Top leaders from the country, including the Prime Minister, are holding these mass rallies, and they are coming in from strong criticism from all quarters, wondering why the government is not being more vigilant, why there isn't a stronger national response to this crisis.
The BBC's Yogita Lamay in Mumbai. We will certainly keep an eye on the COVID spread in India. Thank you so much, Yogita.
Thank you.
And in some parts of the country, many of you have seen this TV ad. We watch as a young, attractive white woman wakes up and grabs her Glock G42 from the drawer of her night table, puts it into her red designer purse, heads out to her car. She brings it to a board meeting, out for lunch with a friend, then to the gym where she stashes the purse in a locker while she does yoga. Her day ends at a shooting range, but much of the rest would have been illegal in several states. That's one of the reasons ads are being targeted by New Jersey in a unique lawsuit that many, including gun industry execs, sees the most consequential legal battle over the future of guns. Gun makers are largely protected by federal law from suits claiming their product harms people. So the new lawsuit targets ads for consumer fraud. And Andrew Ross Sorkin says the new approach could do to the gun industry what lawsuits against tobacco companies did to that industry in the 90s. Sorkin is a columnist for the New York Times, founder and editor of Deal Book, an online daily financial report. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, and describe some of the things you're seeing in these ads.
Well, there's a number of ads that Smith & Wesson have created, as have other gun makers, that raise all sorts of questions about their legality. Many of them show people carrying guns to places that they typically could not otherwise carry these guns unless they had a concealed carry permit, for example, or other ads that the sense of the ad is targeting people under the age of 18, which would make it illegal for them to buy the gun. So what you have is the state of New Jersey in this instance really going to Smith & Wesson and claiming these ads are fraudulent.
Well, and it's one thing to say an ad is fraudulent, but there's a deeper purpose here, and that is trying to get documents that surrounded the making of the ad. Tell us about that.
Well, so that's what's so interesting about this, because on the face of it, it's about advertising fraud, but really it's not about advertising fraud at all. This is a novel and unique effort by the state of New Jersey to pursue what's known in the legal world as discovery, to be able to get a judge to subpoena and demand emails, internal documents, and the like from inside of Smith & Wesson. And historically, gun makers have been largely protected from almost any kind of real legal case, which has resulted in almost no discovery of the way companies operate, what kinds of conversations are happening internally. And so this lawsuit, if successful, potentially could be the first window that the public ever really has into the inner workings of a gun maker, and potentially explosive if these documents and emails and other things reflect a view, which I think the public may or may not have, that inside these companies, the gun makers know that these guns are being used in, clearly inappropriate ways.
The correlation would be it was discovered during the huge lawsuits against the tobacco industry that people, executives, knew that smoking killed people.
The hope among the gun safety lobby, of course, and I think prosecutors in this instance, is that there will be emails that will reflect not that they know that guns kill people. Of course they're going to know that guns kill people because that's what guns do. But that these guns are being disproportionately sold to people in ways that they shouldn't be, that there are steps that they've considered taking to protect people, but then have ultimately decided against it for profit or other reasons. I mean, I think you could see a real dialogue, potentially, especially given the fact that gun companies have been so protected. I think there's an expectation almost that there will be some revelatory documents which would really expose the gun companies in ways that they haven't been thus far.
Well, Smith & Wesson is adding to that speculation because they're trying to block the subpoena for their documents, saying that the whole investigation is looking to suppress and punish lawful speech regarding gun ownership in order to advance an anti-Second Amendment agenda. So you got two layers there. You've got New Jersey saying this is consumer fraud because they're showing people in the ads doing things that would be illegal. But more important, they're trying to get these other documents.
Both of the positions are somewhat hypocritical because, of course, the government's saying this is really just about fraud and nothing more, when in fact there's a whole second layer, as we just discussed. And in truth, you have the gun companies saying, look, these people are clearly trying to go after us who are anti-Second Amendment. So there is an element of hypocrisy in terms of how this whole case is being treated. Having said that, Smith & Wesson has clearly gone to the mat here to say that there should be no discovery in this case whatsoever. And you would imagine if they were very comfortable with the advertising on its face, they would be okay, you would think. I mean, these kinds of cases happen all the time. Most of the requests here are going to be around documents that touch on the advertising. But what's so interesting about that is the communication that they might have with an advertising agency or, again, internally about who they're trying to market towards, what they're trying to do, some of the issues that might come up in advertising when they think about these things. That's really where I think the state of New Jersey thinks there might be actually interesting conflict.
Well, and meanwhile, this lawsuit, where are we on it? A sense of time?
Oh, goodness. These things take a very, very long time. I think we're going to wait probably for another good month or two to hear back from the judge on this initial ruling. I'm sure there will be appeals. This is a story that is not going away. I believe we'll be talking about this for years.
Well, that's New York Times columnist Andrew Ross Sorkin. And we will follow this New Jersey lawsuit targeting gunmaker Smith & Wesson for advertising. They hope that that will get to the inner documents of the gunmaker. Andrew, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. Really appreciate it.
Police across the country are under increased scrutiny, and that's the case in Boston, where the department is facing some of its most pressing issues in years. The department has been without a leader for more than 2 months. A newly appointed commissioner was placed on leave after allegations of domestic abuse, and the Boston Globe reports that the department kept quiet that a longtime police officer and union leader was an alleged child molester. Allie Jarmanning from member station WBUR has the story.
The last time the Boston Police Department was under this kind of scrutiny was in the early 90s. That era was marked by the St. Clair Commission, a committee tasked by then-Mayor Ray Flynn to investigate the police department. It found a shoddy internal investigation system, and it recommended the police chief be fired. He wasn't. 30 years later, the department is under the microscope again.
There is a crisis in confidence and in the public trust that the community needs to have in its police department.
That's former Boston Police Lieutenant Tom Nolan, now a sociology professor at Emmanuel College. He says what the police department is doing is nothing new.
Culturally, the police organization exists to avoid scrutiny from what the police see as interlopers, people from the outside who don't understand their world.
What's different now is the political climate. Since the killing of George Floyd by officers in Minnesota last May, police departments have faced enormous pressure to change.
Now what we're seeing is just an increasing level of strident criticism on the part of the public. The drumbeat has been steadily increasing in the last couple of years in ways that it had not historically.
Like many cities, Boston is undertaking a host of reforms to improve the accountability of the police department. They include a brand new office to investigate police misconduct. But the reforms aren't yet in place, and it's not clear who will be in charge of implementing them. There's an interim police commissioner in place, while suspended Commissioner Dennis White is investigated. And the city has an acting mayor, since Mayor Marty Walsh became Joe Biden's labor secretary last month. It won't be clear who the next mayor will be until the fall. That all creates uncertainty about the future of the department.
A lot of folks are kind of on standby. What are we doing? What's our mission? How do you want us to get there?
That's Dan Linsky. He's a former Boston police superintendent and now head of the Boston office of the security firm Kroll. Linsky says officers are still responding to 911 calls and investigating crimes, but the cultural changes, like creating more transparency, can't move forward.
That's a bigger conversation, and it's bigger than the Boston Police Department. And it's tough to have that conversation while you're waiting for personnel to change.
On top of the recent turmoil, the city has long struggled to reduce violence and solve shootings in poor neighborhoods. Just last weekend, a 73-year-old great-grandmother, Delois Brown, was shot and killed as she sat on her porch. Boston police have yet to announce any arrests. Over the last decade, only about a third of the murders in the city have been solved. The rate is even worse for Black victims. Those in the community are anxiously waiting to see what happens next with the department. Emmett Folgert is a neighborhood activist.
Anytime there's a transition of power in a police department, we get nervous.
He says right now is a critical time, heading into summer when crime typically rises. Community groups need support from the police department as they plan events and activities for kids in the neighborhood.
The crime rate hasn't gone down. The crime rate has gone up. Shootings aren't down. The shootings are up. The homicides are up. So we need to work together.
For now, Folgert and the rest of Boston are waiting to see what's next and how new leadership might move the department and the city forward. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Jarmani.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Whether you're looking to discover a new series to binge, find your next great read, or check out that movie everyone's talking about, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is your guide to all things entertainment. Every weekday, we keep pop culture in high spirits. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
We reported here a study showing that a third of all COVID-19 patients will suffer from neurological symptoms up to 6 months after infection, things like anxiety or even psychosis. And those aren't even the long haulers who never quite get well. The Survivor Corps Support Network says their symptoms number more than 100. Mount Sinai Hospital's Center for Post-COVID Care opened last May to treat them. Dr. Si-Jin Chen is the director. And Dr. Chen, you were swamped. Is it still busy?
Well, I think the demand is still very great. Day after day, we're still seeing a large amount of patients still reporting symptoms as you described just now, and they're still looking to get into the center to be seen and to be treated.
Yeah. We spoke with Diana Barrett in December. She's the founder of the Survivor Corps Support Group. 7 months after COVID, she developed a new symptom, glaucoma. Her teenage son suddenly lost a tooth, just fell out of his mouth. What are you seeing?
It's very hard to quantify how much and how many different symptoms there are. Day after day and month after month, there are many people coming to us telling us about new symptoms that we haven't heard before. Common symptoms are things like shortness of breath, tachycardia, chest pain, as well as the neurological effects that you name. But there are rare symptoms also, such as the anosmia, the inability to smell, the dysgeusia, having trouble with taste, as well as things like tinnitus, ringing in the ears.
Well, and what about what would seem like a blessing if it's widespread and true. Patients who are reporting that after they take the vaccine, it's alleviating some of the symptoms. CNN reported on a woman who hadn't been able to exercise in over 6 months. She could barely breathe, had the vaccine, and she's swimming over a mile.
I don't think currently there's any large-scale reporting from any of the centers that we're, you know, working with. And there are some studies on the way to study whether or not the vaccine actually is causing improvement in the patients. In regards to why this is happening, it is a little bit of a mystery. We're presuming that the virus had really been eradicated from our bodies after the initial infection. So getting a vaccine, it doesn't make sense that, you know, it is actually helping the symptoms. Some theory out there is that maybe there's a repository of the virus still within our body, not in the circulation, so we can't detect it, and the vaccine is activating our immune system to fight it. And then another theory is that when you go through such a traumatic event, you know, there are changes that can occur to a patient's psychological well-being. And getting a vaccine might give patients hope. And that hope alone actually can change some of their symptoms.
Right. Well, doctor, I want to ask you, because you said the premise is that the virus, once you're well, it's left you. But I thought that viruses could linger. I had polio as a child, and I thought that the polio virus, for instance, can still live in you, which is why decades later, people can have something called post-polio. They can have paralysis.
More than just polio. I mean, there are other viruses that do the same thing. The herpes virus, which causes shingles, I mean, it's from an early infection. It reactivates when your body is weak. Is it a possibility with this virus? I can say that yes, it is a possibility, but there's no way to actually detect it. You know, we're trying our hardest just to learn as quickly as possible.
Dr. Zijian Chen, director of Mount Sinai Hospital Center for Post-COVID Care. It was the first in the country. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Today is Jackie Robinson Day across Major League Baseball. Robinson made history when he ended 80 years of baseball segregation by being the first black player in an MLB game on April 15, 1947, and he was a star on the field from that first day. Robinson was the Rookie of the Year in 1947, and 2 years later, he was the National League's Most Valuable Player and elected into baseball's Hall of Fame in 1962. Our next guest writes about Robinson's activism as part of his new book, 42 Today, Jackie Robinson and His Legacy. Uhuru Williams is a professor of history and founding director of the Racial Justice Initiative at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he joins us now on Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Williams, you're in Minnesota, where there's so much energy, as we know, swirling around the trial of Derek Chauvin for the killing of George Floyd, and now Daunte Wright, who was also killed by police in your state. You're a son of history. As we reflect on Jackie Robinson, how are you processing this moment?
You know what's really powerful about this moment, Tanya, is that Jack actually, post-baseball, was very active in the civil rights movement. And in 1963, he went down to Birmingham to participate in several protests associated with the Birmingham campaign at the invitation of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And he gives a speech where he talks about images that are being broadcast back to New York and the East about what's happening in the South. And specifically, he speaks about the image of what he calls this brave policeman down here with his knee on the neck of this lady. It's a really powerful speech because it connects that historical moment with our contemporary moment. Here's Jack, somebody who Martin Luther King described as a freedom rider before the freedom rides, because before Jack integrated baseball, he had refused to give up his seat on a segregated bus while he was in the military, and who had been, you know, by default drafted into the movement, now going down to Birmingham and calling attention to not only the segregation, but the police brutality that enforced it. And this is one of those themes that runs throughout African-American history, that runs throughout American history, and which really connects our past with our present.
Absolutely. You know, Major League Baseball, as we know, is celebrating this day. It's the one where Robinson took to the field for the first time for the Dodgers. And in your essay, I've Got to Be Me, in this latest book, you explore the perceptions about Robinson's commitment to this Black freedom movement. Some actually saw him as a symbol of progress, others as a tool for the establishment. Can you say more about this?
There were certainly elements in the society as a whole that celebrated Jack's accomplishment. The idea that you could have an African-American taking the field, being able to play in the same stadiums as white players, and who performed on a level that was outstanding. And Jack fulfilled all of that. And he became a hero to many for that. At the same time, there were those who saw and associated the indignities that Jack had to suffer with him being a sellout, essentially a tool of the Dodgers and a tool of Branch Rickey. And one of his most infamous critics was Malcolm X, Minister Malcolm X from the Nation of Islam. And Malcolm took great, relished in kind of deriding Jackie Robinson for being what he called Mr. Rickey's Negro. And basically playing him out to be kind of a stooge for the establishment. The reality is Jack was very much an independent, and you see that in his political thinking. You see that in his activism. You see that in the way that he goes about challenging inequality, both on the baseball diamond, but also in the larger society. Jackie Robinson was very similar to James Meredith in that they were both kind of loners and independents. We often think about James Meredith and his march against fear through Mississippi in 1966, kind of taking that lone road. And Jack, in some sense, occupies that for sports. He is the first to integrate baseball. And then later on in his civil rights activism, he's an independent thinker, and it's hard to pin him down with regard to his position on civil rights, on Black power. It really just depended on where Jack was in that moment. And that's one of the hallmarks of his independent thought.
I'm curious about, do we know how Jackie Robinson felt about the comments Malcolm X made about him and those feelings?
We do. Jack was a prolific letter writer, and we're fortunate to have access to many of those letters. Of course, his widow, Rachel, has spoken at length about Jack and his activism. But what's interesting to me is that he was someone who did not take things personal. In fact, I write in the essay, it's interesting, you know, after the Mexico City protests in 1968, or on the eve of those Mexico City protests, where Juan Carlos and Tommy Smith are going to raise their clenched fists in support of Black power at Mexico City, you've got Jack acknowledging in his newspaper column that Malcolm X was right. And so he and Malcolm had these, you know, kind of bitter battles in the press. And yet Jack always maintained a respect for Minister Malcolm. In fact, he writes, and I'll share this with you. I just found this very compelling. He wrote in his Pittsburgh Courier column, "I began to give the matter some careful thought, and I got hold of the clips from the media which told the story of the boycott movement. After doing this, I was not so certain that the proposed boycott was a bad idea. I decided it's something that the American public ought to at least look at. Maybe that's our problem. Maybe we as Negro athletes have been around too long, accepting inequities and indignities and going along with the worn out promises about things, how things are going to get better. If this is the way the youngsters feel, believe me, I can sympathize with their point of view. Malcolm X, the late and brilliant leader, once pointed out to me during the course of a debate that, quote, Jackie, in days to come, your son and my son will not be willing to settle for the things we are willing to settle for. I'm certain that this is correct, and this is the way it should be." And that's, you know, an indication of, you know, Jack's ability to absorb criticism and to, not take it personal.
This is really remarkable, hearing it back from you. I mean, these very public battles between Malcolm X and Jackie Robinson, and then this writing where he kind of laid out and reflected on that. Something happened in the 80s and the 90s, and I want to know if you agree with me here. The stories of our heroes like Jackie Robinson somehow got constricted or simplified sometimes as a way to impart on children sort of this unified depiction of who they were. The nuances that you speak of here are often not part of the narrative that we talk about. From your view, how important are these stories to understand where we are now, and really the man that was Jackie Robinson?
It's such a great question, Tanya, and they're absolutely essential. It's the reason why I call Jackie Robinson Jack, because that's what Rachel called him, and that's what his friends and intimates called him. Jackie is really a creation of the media, a creation of the popular imagination of that moment. It's only one segment of a remarkably complex human being who, when you get to know him through his letters, when you get to know him through his newspaper columns, he was a prolific writer, through his activism, was an incredibly complex man, a very deep man, a very spiritual person of faith, but his own thinker, an independent thinker. And it's one of the reasons that I agree with you is that we often do this to our heroes. We like to reduce American history to a simple progress narrative, and we force everyone uncomfortably into that mold and tell their stories in such a way that we want to highlight that progress. And we miss the messiness, the complexity in their lives, the fact that the journey is incomplete. I love the fact that when John Lewis passed last summer in his final letter to the American people, he talked about freedom as a constant struggle. In our contemporary moment, as we look at athletes like LeBron James and Kyrie Irving, who are using their platform, and especially the women in the WNBA using their platform to highlight racial injustice, I go back to Jack and his struggles as the first African-American to integrate baseball in the major leagues in the 20th century. And the fact that we, in telling that story in a particular way, lose that longitudinal engagement of what it meant to resist and incredible pressure that these athletes face and the incredible power they had to use their platforms for good. Long before there was Colin Kaepernick, there was Jack. And we don't want to lose that element of that story as well. It's an important part of who he was. And it helps to connect, again, you know, where we are today with this very rich, important history that documents the struggle for African-American equality in the United States.
Yehuru Williams, thank you so much for this conversation. And I'm going to remember Jack versus Jackie.
Appreciate that.
Yehuru Williams is a professor of history at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota.
So have you been Sweding, S-W-E-D-I-N-G? Well, maybe you have and not known it. Do you recreate scenes from a favorite film and post the videos on TikTok or YouTube? You are Sweding, especially as people have been looking for outlets during the pandemic. We'll have links to some Sweding videos at hereandnow.org. They are hilarious. But Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr has been watching some and he joins us now. Ty, this is so refreshing.
I think so, too. It's a tribute to the ingenuity of people stuck at home.
Yeah. And tell us where the term Sweding comes from. This is the 2008 Michel Gondry film Be Kind, Rewind. It's about two video store clerks. Tell us.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, fluky comedy where Jack Black and Mos Def play video store clerks who accidentally erase their entire stock and then figure out that, well, we'll go out and we'll do remakes. We'll make our own remakes of Jurassic Park and, you know, whatever, all these movies. And they tell the customers the movies are from Sweden and they catch on and people start making their own.
And Michel Gondry has one of the most popular. It's his version of Martin Scorsese's classic Taxi Driver. It's in French. And so Gondry is recreating De Niro's lines in front of the mirror.
Ça va, tu parles? Non?
Ben moi, je vois personne d'autre, hein. Donc tu m'as parlé à moi.
Si tu veux parler.
C'est toi qui as parlé?
Are you talking to me?
C'est toi qui parles?
Gondry's kind of a genius anyway. I mean, this is the guy who made Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and other wonderful movies. He also, I discovered recently, he did a Sweden trailer for Be Kind, Rewind. That's how committed he is to this concept.
Well, and there's a film festival. We'll have everything at herenow.org, by the way. We'll have some of these samples. But, you know, it's what you see sometimes when these are being made. You say the vegetable peeler is a murder weapon in the Sweden Gone Girl. There's a typhoon in a shower stall in the lighthouse. A desperate struggle to scale a 3-foot-tall chain-link fence for escape from New York.
Well, I mean, and that is the kind of wonder of Sweeting, is that you do not try and make your film look as good as the original, because you never will. So you might as well flaunt the absurdities, the cheapness, the impossibility of, with, given the lack of resources that you have and the lack of a Hollywood budget. There's a wonderful Sweeted version of Escape from New York, which has, again, that scene you just mentioned of them trying to scale a 3-foot chain link fence. But also the actor playing Snake Plissken in that movie has his beards double drawn on with a Sharpie. It's things like that that really make the difference between a successful Sweeted film and an unsuccessful Sweeted film.
Yeah. And let's look at another of your favorite Sweeting videos. This is a version of Jaws. Let's listen to a little, then you tell us what we're seeing.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
That's a 20-footer. 25. 3 tons of...
We're going to need a bigger boat. What are we seeing?
You're seeing a bunch of kids flying, you know, running around in a backyard swimming pool. But they replicate like the scene where the sheriff is sitting on the beach and the camera zooms in as the kid gets, you know, eaten out in the by the shark out in the sea. They replicate a lot of the shots, but using their living room and using their kitchen. And there's a guy dressed up as Robert Shaw sitting there playing the grand piano in the filmmaker's living room. And the bigger boat that they're going to need is an inflatable pool boat. And of course, the shark is an inflatable shark. But the shot language is very, very close to the Spielberg version. One of the things that makes Sweeting so much fun is to see how close you can come to the feel without any of the resources.
A version of the Sweeted Wizard of Oz shows the wizard saying, "Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain," and it's a shower curtain. No Country for Swede Men. In that Sweeting, when a dog is chasing the Llewellyn Moss character through the woods, it's a guy on the all fours yelling, "Bark."
So a lot of these were in the Sweeted Film Festival, which is online and costs $4. But you can find free versions as well if you go to SweetedCinema.com. It's sort of a repository for a bunch of different Sweeted versions. There's a Forrest Gump in there. There's a Back to the Future. There's a Kill Bill.
Well, let's hear a little of Kill Bill. This is the classic fight scene where the bride takes on the crazy 88, but it's in someone's living room. There's a Lion King in a sandbox, and
yes,
where Rafiki lifts the infant lion cub, Simba, into the air in the beginning, it's an orange and white cat.
Right. And you know, that's part of the fun is sort of taking the power away from Hollywood and saying, look, we can do this too. And we can do it with just what we have lying around at hand. And we can make our own sort of small-scaled, home-scaled version of, you know, these Hollywood films. And I don't think it's an accident. In fact, I know it's not an accident that so many of the Sweeted films in the past year that are in this online festival feature kids, because it's a great way to get kids involved, especially when they're sitting at home and aren't at school.
Yeah, wonderful. That's Sweeting. We've been talking about it with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. We'll have, again, links to all the Sweeting videos to the film festival at herenow.org. Ty, thanks. I needed that.
As did I. Thank you, Robin.
And I am Robin Young. Tanya, I want to do King Kong with my cat. I'll be Fay Wray.
Taxi Driver. Wouldn't that be funny?
Oh. You. It's Here and Now.